all yours, Melissa.
Great. Well, thank you. For microphone purposes, I'm going to stand here and flip slides, and then Katie and John will sit there. So my name is Elizabeth Tomlin. I'm general counsel for the Archdiocese for the Military Services. I've served as general counsel for 8 years and then dual-hatted for a bit as the interim director of development. So that was a fun time. And have worked with JKT for setting up the Archdiocesan Foundation, the St. John the 23rd Foundation. And within my professional career, I kind of managed the day-to-day of several separately incorporated entities for the Archdiocese.
I'm Katie Acuff. I am an associate vice president at Tulane University here in New Orleans. I'm a founding partner of JKT Group, so it's work that I do in my spare time when I find it. I have been a fundraiser in higher ed for 22 years now. At Tulane, we are in the midst of a campaign. We just crossed $1.7 billion. Wow. I've raised about $100 million myself in that time frame. So fundraising is my thing. I will talk about it all day long if anyone wants to talk later. I have to say, I'm just going to give a plug for this book for anyone in the room that is a fundraiser. A Spirituality of Fundraising by Henry Nouwen is excellent. I'm rereading it for probably the fourth time, and I think it's just a great inspiration. And that prayer made me think of it. So.
Good morning, John Schlegeter. I'm one of the founding partners of JKT Group. I do this full time, and I have the support staff that helps me with it. If you were at the foundation session, Corey talked about those lawyers that go through your bylaws and articles and help put your foundation on track. I am that lawyer, and I walked around the room last night to see if there were any other of those lawyers at the booths. So I am still the only lawyer in the room who has a practice doing this. We founded JKT Group on this idea that there is the need for Catholic smaller organizations to have some experts come in. We come in, we audit, and in some cases we run or rebuild, restructure foundations from the ground up. So my current client list is I am the executive director of the Archdiocese for Military Services Foundation, the St. John the 23rd Foundation. I am currently the acting executive director of the Diocese of Colorado Springs. I just left the position after 2 years of restructuring and rebuilding the foundation for the Basilica of the Assumption in Baltimore, the Preservation Trust. I have a few other clients that I'm currently right now auditing, including the Diocese of Springfield in Illinois, not where they eat the cats and dogs, and a few other foundations that I've audited throughout the years. In addition to that, I do practice law. I have a very small practice where if you need a lawyer to actually do your bylaws, Margaret from the Diocese of Lafayette can attest to the fact that I'll go in, create you articles, create you bylaws, and build. I'm also general counsel for the Eparchy of St. Maron of Brooklyn, the Maronite church in the eastern half of the United States. And I'm always so happy when Elizabeth is in the room because time that the Archdiocese for Military Services gets a lawyer who's not a halfwit, because from 2007 to 2016, I was the general counsel of the Archdiocese for Military Services. I'll stop talking.
That was a very good line, John. I hope you keep using it. Okay, so one of the foundational questions that anybody needs to answer is, why create a foundation in the first place? If you have a foundation that's kind of stagnant, or if you're thinking, well, we really should think about creating a foundation, why create a foundation in the first instance? So,
and
Mr. Schlegeter?
Sure. And before I get into this, we want this to be a conversation with you. So, stop us. We have a slideshow that, we threw together, but, let's have this be more of a dialogue and questions answer. So why set up a foundation? It's very simple. Asset protection and asset growth. And if everybody in the room can say asset protection, we'll all be on a better page, because asset protection, we think of that as a scary word. We're hiding money. We're sheltering money. We're keeping this away from the bad lawyers who are trying to get at our money. That's not what we're doing. We are protecting these assets, which is a stewardship responsibility of Catholic organizations. If there is a better way to protect your gifts, why aren't you using it? And that's why the foundation model is used by so many dioceses, and asset growth, because the power of compounding interest, which Katie will talk about, when you look at the numbers, we had a client that was a foundation created 40 years ago. They'd never put a penny in the bank. It was just used for capital campaigns. And we looked at it and said, if you put $20,000 in the bank every year when you created this institution and compounded that interest, it would be worth about $40 million today. But there was no concept of that. So that's what... why you create a foundation. And at the end of the day, a foundation is created as a grant-making institution. Every penny that goes out is a grant. And so in order to have the ability to make those grants, you need those assets.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay. So models of foundations used today, we have a couple proposals, and perhaps your diocese or entity does it a little differently.
So in the practice, these are the models we've found. The first is just that the diocesan foundation is an asset managing institution. You make a little money, you park it in the foundation. The diocese has a capital campaign. They've got too much money that's not being spent. What do you do with it? It's almost the tail wagging the dog of where are we going to park this money? We put it in a foundation. At the end of the day, that's really a trust because you're just compounding interest. It's not a living corporation you have three or four trustees or boards of directors who are just doing asset management, and then the diocese asks for money and then you make a grant from that. I have seen that model in a lot of smaller dioceses. I have a lot of dioceses that think they have a diocesan foundation, but they're operating it as a diocesan trust. And if anyone wants me to expand on how that works, it does work if that's what you're looking for. A trust is a great way to park money and let it grow, but it's not a mechanism by which to continue to grow those assets other than if your beneficiary is going to continue to park money into the trust. The second model is the one that we've employed at the Archdiocese for Military Services and at the St. John the 23rd Foundation, and the fundraising staff of the Archdiocese is in the back, and so I always thank them for we all play very nice in our sandboxes. We are not in the same sandbox, but we are able to play well together. And that's where you have assets being gifted from the beneficiary institution to the foundation, and then the foundation does limited fundraising for its endowments, but the staff of the beneficiary organization, be it the diocese or a school or a basilica or other institution, continues to fundraise for gifts to the endowment of the foundation, but those gifts are made to the foundation. So if Sal gets a $1 million gift to somebody who wants to support the education and formation of seminarians, he calls me up and says, I've got a $1 million gift, and I say to him, I will take it from here. So he gets to put it on his books, but the cash goes to the foundation. And the third model is the one that we see being incorporated by more dioceses across the United States, and that's the university model. And since I don't work for a university, and Katie does, she's going to talk about how that model actually works within the diocesan structure, because we have worked with a few dioceses in incorporating the university model into their foundation.
And I'll start by saying that every university is different. You know, UVA has a foundation for every school within the university, and it is like the wild, wild west. Other institutions, like Tulane, has a more centralized model where all of the frontline fundraising operation is centralized, and we have liaisons to each individual school. So they report into advancement, but they work with a dean. We handle the president. It's across the board. We handle everything. It works because instead of each individual apostolate going to the same people and asking for small dollars, $5,000 here, $5,000 there, and people feeling constantly asked, it's more of a donor-centric model where it's about the relationship with the between the donor and the institution. And when one person is taking the lead on the strategy for that donor, you're in a better position to, one, really understand what it is that the donor is passionate about. You know, that one person, or maybe it's even the bishop. I mean, there are a lot of cases. I have a portfolio, and some of the people do not know who I am because I orchestrate every single thing that goes on in their relationship with the university. It's that the president's writing them, a dean is writing them, and they will never know who I am. So you've got this model where it's very relationship focused, and that person is able to ask the donor, what would you like to accomplish with your money that is meaningful to you? And when you really start to focus, suddenly you get people who are going to tell you exactly what it is that they want to accomplish with their money. And when they say it, it is very natural for you to go back to them and solicit them for that very thing. You can continue to ask them for annual fund gifts. You can continue to ask them to sponsor different events. But it's a much bigger picture ask. It puts you in a position to ask for more and ask in a way and for something that is very, very meaningful to them.
And Katie, for the university model, and if a diocese applied this, then the diocese itself is not doing any fundraising, but all of that is accomplished through the foundation, correct?
Through the foundation, right.
Okay.
So your fundraising staff would all report into the foundation, and you would probably have someone who's working with Catholic Charities, someone who's working with the schools, someone who's working with a food bank, and so on and so on. But they would all work together as a team and strategize. So there's one relationship manager, but there are a lot of team members. And you sit around and you talk about strategy. You develop a strategy. You time out everything that you're going to do. In September, I'm going to do this. In October, I'm going to do this. In November, they're going to have lunch with the bishop. In December, this is what we're going to ask for. And you map that out. You can do it for an entire year at a time. Sometimes I'm mapping things out for 3 to 5 years to get to that ultimate gift.
Yeah. So I do want to mention that the pictures I selected were not random stock photos off of Pixabay or whatever. Really to communicate that no organization is too small to start thinking about purposeful, about an endowment. This is one of the apostolates for the military archdiocese that is, I've been trying to communicate for a while to get out of these subsistence fundraising, but really like plan for your future through an endowment. And this is a, JKT works with, for Haitian relief.
We worked with a diocese that had a foundation only for its apostolate in Haiti. So it had an outreach to Haiti foundation that was, under the diocese. The bishop was the corporate member. Actually, they had a corporate membership of 5 people because it was a Connecticut corporation, which requires that. And that was what that foundation did, and they did it very well. We were invited to come in and audit and worked with the board of directors to do a little coaching on how to better build their institution for long-term sustainable impact. So we don't just do dioceses.
Which brings us to the next point, and this is the Baltimore Basilica Trust, which JKT works with. So when to start your endowment, the power of compounding.
Yeah, the when to start the endowment was yesterday.
Right.
And these are not Baltimore's numbers. These are just as an example. So does everyone understand the concept of an endowment and how it works and how it pays out and how it grows? Okay. So if you're starting with $1 million in 10 years, you could, assuming a 10% return, that's a very generous number, but it's for the sake of easy numbers. Yeah. So after 10 years, that corpus is worth almost $1.5 million, and it has paid out $81,000. You can go to the next slide. So looking at it another way, this is your payout over 10 years. You see that the corpus is worth 1.5 because it's been growing in the market. So the total value of that $1 million gift is over $2 million within 10 years. And it gets even better because when you do it over 20 years, that $1 million is now worth $4 million, and it is paying out every year close to $1.5 million. And this is a way, I mean, when you show donors this kind of opportunity, it becomes hard for them to say no. If you're managing, especially if you're managing the money well, if you're getting those kinds of returns, it's really hard to say no. Because institutions, every once in a while you'll have a donor who will say, I can do better than that. I can invest the money myself and do that, which is fine. There are ways to accept those gifts. But generally speaking, it's hard to compete with these kinds of numbers.
I always say to donors, if you're trying to understand how an endowment works, it's a 401k or an IRA for your diocese, or if it's a parish fund, it's a 401k for your parish. And that just makes sense to people because you put all this money over your career into a fund and then look at it and realize You're getting paid $60,000 for the last 20 years, but you've got $2 million in a 401k.
Great. So next, you're ready to start your foundation or revamp it from yesterday. And if you're working with JKT or if you're working within your foundation to consider how you do this, question number one is your mission. What is your mission? So this image is St. George slaying the dragon, Christ, of course, and then St. John the 23rd, military chaplain, future pope. And these are the mosaics in the back of the Military Archdiocese Chapel. And so the mission of the Military Archdiocese, created by St. John Paul the Great in 1985, to serve as a personal archdiocese for members of the military, their families, and patients in the 153 VA medical centers. When we created the foundation, we wanted to make sure that there would be potential to serve members of the military in a way that might not be such a personal related jurisdiction, but yet is still a very, very tight Venn diagram with the mission of the Military Archdiocese. So it's broader, nourishing the faith of Catholics in the armed forces and the Department of Veterans Affairs medical centers, so the 153 VA medical centers. And what that allows is for the St. John the 23rd Foundation to hold an endowment or to grant something with a partner organization. I don't know, Word on Fire is very benevolent to the military, something like that that the archdiocese typically wouldn't partner with, but could be something broader that the foundation could. John, any thoughts on that?
I think when you're building an endowment and you're building a foundation, you have to be mindful of the funds you're accepting. And that was something that came up yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, anyone can create an endowment. Well, that's a very scary place to be. Mrs. McGillicuddy comes in with a $2,000 gift. I'm going to create an endowment, and I want it to be for the school, but it's not going to go to the school. It's going to go to a kid of the school, and it's going to be decided as the distribution is going to be decided by the foundation, but it's the grant is going to be made by the parish council, and the pastor has a veto, and this is for one-legged paraplegics who are at least 6 foot tall, and from, I mean, they all of these conditions and those ones, that's an administrative nightmare. So if you're focusing, and I've seen it so many times, a well-intentioned fundraiser wants every dollar on their books, and that, you know, Mrs. McGillicuddy, this is a wonderful gift for the one-legged paraplegic in the parish who's going to get shoes every year. But that doesn't work in a diocesan foundation. No pet projects. Keep the pet projects out of the foundation. And if you're looking at your mission and who you are, if you are a diocesan foundation, then you have to support diocesan ministries and diocesan apostolates. I ran a foundation for a university for a number of years. We had so many people who wanted to give endowments for scholarships. Well, scholarships are a great thing if you're a student at the university, but it doesn't do anything for the university because it's simply covering someone's tuition. Now, at the end of the day, it's found money, but if you're building something for the diocese or for another charity, make sure that it's for that charity, that it's going to advance the purpose, and keep your funds simple. I'm looking at some clients. They've got 175 funds in their diocesan foundation. We at Military Services, we have four, and we're keeping it at four. We have a general endowed fund because that's the best kind of fund you can have. We have a fund for seminarians and their education, which was very easy to raise money for, but right now we're just compounding interest because there's more money in the fund than there are seminarians. So that's, you know, make sure you have a sunset clause or a way to get out of that. We have a fund for the retirement of bishops, and then another something that the bishop asked us to establish as a drawdown fund. So, you know, be mindful that, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I think we all learned that in Catholic school. But know what you're putting into your endowment, because for the next, you know, perpetuity, you're going to have to deal with the administrative nightmare of those funds if there are too many conditions. I'll stop talking.
Yeah, so when you're having the gift acceptance letter, like John said, a clause that describes what happens if that fund comes to its natural conclusion. You know, if you know that you have billions and millions of dollars for seminary and education and you won't need it, does that fund revert to the general endowed fund, which is a way to keep it useful so that you're not trying to buy one pair of shoes for, you know, Mrs. McGillicuddy's project. So next up, the role of the bishop in the foundation. This is a question we've received a lot throughout the weekend or throughout our time here, and whether the bishop is a member of the corporation, whether he's one member of many, whether he has a vote, whether he doesn't have a vote, and then almost a conflation between having your bishop as a corporate member versus the foundation being a corporation sole, which is a statutory construction. So, John, do you want to start and I'll finish talking?
Sure. The corporate member is creating a two-tiered board of directors. The bishop is the corporate member. I've seen all kinds of types of corporate members. The one that I'm seeing the most right now is the bishop, the vicar general, the chancellor, maybe the general counsel. That's a farce. Stop doing that. It's the bishop. The bishop has the vicar general and the bishop are the same person. The chancellor's not going to go against the bishop, and the general counsel's going to lose his job if he says so if
her.
He votes in a corporate membership meeting.
Her.
Make it simple. Her. The general counsel. Her. So keep it simple. Just make the bishop the corporate member, and you can write it into your bylaws and your articles of incorporation or your articles of amendment. The bishop is the corporate member because. This is an apostolate of the Catholic Church, and as such, certain reserve powers have to be empowered to the bishop. Put that kind of language in there because it scares the crap out of a judge because they don't want it to scare, they don't want to touch Catholic stuff. If you put in code of canon law, but you don't make it too specific, but you talk about how it's a Catholic apostolate, that it's First Amendment stuff, they don't want to touch it. But make sure that the reserve powers you're giving the bishop are reserved, that he doesn't have a full authority of the board. The right to remove the board, the right to appoint members, the right to appoint an auditor, the right to confirm the election of the directors, the right to change the philosophy of the institution, the right to approve amendments to the articles, and the right to approve amendments to the bylaws. That's the best way to do it. Those are the reserve powers that ensure that it remains a Catholic institution under the guidance of the bishop, but governed by its board of directors. Yes. Now, I can understand that. And if your model works for you, that's fine. I'm not saying, and every state is different. In Connecticut, you have to have 5 members on a corporate membership. And so a lot of dioceses have to put the vicar general and the chancellor. And if it works for you, that's fine. But I think the bishop is going to consult with his vicar general and his chancellor anyway, no matter what, because almost all the bishops that I've worked for do that. It's whether or not you want them on the membership. And I think that legally, If you look at a membership, even if it's 3 people of the vicar general, the chancellor, and the bishop, it's the bishop. And if you're looking at it as that apostolate of the Catholic Church, and so certain reserve powers have to be left to the member, well, those powers are reserved to the bishop, not the bishop, the chancellor, and the vicar general. So I think it's just something to consider when looking at your organization. Yes?
We're just kind of revitalizing our foundation. And we have bylaws, and the attorney wrote those for us. The question that we had, and it took us 6 months to finally decide on the canon law, if we
include the canon law phrases, or if we leave them out and just have them as an attachment. And we finally ended up just merging them together. It finally came to that. What do you suggest?
I don't like reference to particular canons in bylaws because
bylaws are the governing document for a U.S. 501c3 nonprofit corporation. The instrument that governs a canonical institution are canonical statutes. And when you start mixing canonical statutes, you get this hybrid system of a canonical institution and also then you bring in your canonists. I think the more you keep this a civil 501c3 corporation, I only say use the code of canon law for the membership because it gives the power to the bishop that he is required to have as the bishop of the diocese. So you're not alienating him. But when you start mixing the two together, it just makes me nervous. But if it works for you, it works for you. And you know, I'm sure most of you have wonderful bylaws. I think the problem with bylaws is that some lawyer wrote them 40 years ago and just changed the name and the faces on the document from the last 40 bylaws that he wrote. And it might work very well for your institution, but no one's read the bylaws in 40 years. And I think that's where a good governance committee and an audit committee comes in. We had a client, and I won't say any names, but this client, the chairman of the board of this institution, who had been a major multi-million dollar donor over the years, was probably the most well-respected person in the diocese. He was head of Holy Sepulchre. He was head of Malta. I mean, he was the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral in the diocese. That's as far as Catholics go. And when he retired, the diocesan newspaper put out this beautiful article of XYZ retires after 40 years as chairman of the board of XYZ Foundation. We were brought in. We opened up the Articles of Incorporation. Article 2, the bishop is the chairman of the board. So he had an office for 40 years that he wasn't able to have. So make sure you read your articles. Make sure you read your bylaws. And you know, make sure this is why a good governance and a good audit committee come in. Your bylaws can be changed rather easily. Your bylaws are not some document that you have to follow. It's a document by which you choose to be governed. Your board of directors are the keeper of those bylaws. So if they don't work for you, amend them.
Can I ask you to clarify a little bit more? So keeping canons out of the bylaws, do you recommend that there's one sentence or something that says the organization is
yes.
I
wouldn't say that it's a canonical institution, but the language I would use is reservation of powers to the member or the membership itself. So either what is the membership or who is the member. So the member is Timothy P. Broglio, Archbishop for the Military Services, and his successors in office. Reserve powers. As the foundation is an apostolate of the Catholic Church, and as such, certain powers must be reserved to the member. Those reserved powers are A, B, C, D, E. And I wouldn't say where in the Code of Canon Law, because if you start putting codes in, then judges are going to start reading those codes. But if you just reference the law of the church as the Code of Canon Laws, it just helps them push the brakes a bit.
And to follow up on that, well, yes, one, go ahead. Let me give you a mic for the recording.
Thank you. So just to follow on that thought, so, and in addition, then you're spelling out the governance is then held by the board, and it, which is made up by, you know, people within the diocese. So you're spelling that out or setting that line of distinction. Okay. If I'm hearing you correctly.
Yes, you're putting that line of distinction. And bylaws really need certain things, and I think the two of the most important things, one, committees, and the nomination committee is always very important. So you need a structure by which people are brought onto the board. It has to be an election, a nomination process. I've seen so many boards where it's full of people who have no idea how they got there. Though the bishop wrote me a letter and asked me to serve on the board, so I'm on the board. Have a process by which you are electing directors, and then the corporate member is confirming the election of those directors. He's not appointing, he's confirming the election. And committees. Your board of directors meetings, and we get into committees in a bit here. If you have good committees that are spelled out in your bylaws, your board meeting should be an hour to an hour and a half, 2 hours at the most. The work of your foundation should be happening at the committees. And if the road to hell is paved with good intentions, the road to heaven is paved with a good audit and a good governance committee. That is what will save you at the end of the day. If you have those, not only have those, I've seen great bylaws that have wonderful audit and nominations committees. They've just never met.
So related to canonical language and whether to incorporate it in your bylaws, whether to cite it, I completely agree with John that I would not individually cite canons, because once you do that, you make it kind of enticing for someone to want to reach in and construct it. At civil law, I heard something at the Saturday forum that civil law will trump canon law. I disagree. Because foundationally, it's a jurisdictional question, right? Should your foundation end up in legal trouble, does a court have jurisdiction in the first instance to construe canonical language? And the answer is probably not. And a recent example related to safe environment, so analogous, is the definition of a minor by the Catholic Church. So within the Church, we define a minor as someone who's under 18 or habitually lacks the use of reason. Does that sound familiar? It's in all your safe environment policies. Do I have anybody from the Diocese of Lubbock? So Diocese of Lubbock, a deacon was removed from ministry for boundary violations with a minor. The woman was over 18 but had some mental impairments. The deacon was upset that he was on a credibly accused list and sued the diocese. The trial court in Texas said, well, a minor is just the word minor. We can construe it. She's over 18. The court has jurisdiction to consider this. It went to the Texas Supreme Court. Texas Supreme Court said, no. Minor within the canons and within their policies, within the diocesan policies is defined as over 18 or under 18 and habitually lacks the use of reason. This is a church definition. No jurisdiction. We're not touching it. The bishop's decision to put the deacon on a credibly accused list stood. So, canonical language is important, and making sure that your articles of incorporation, your bylaws, your committee policies, reflect that this is an apostolate of the church that's within the mission of the church is really important now and in ways you might not even consider in the future. So some of the language we see is your foundation a public juridic person? That's a term construed through canon law, which carries certain obligations of the church. It's not synonymous with a civil corporation. I think I have a typo in my slide there. The assets of a public juridic person are ecclesiastical property, which then implicates rules for alienating property. But John, do you want to talk about temporalities, temporal goods? Should I go to the next slide? Because we've talked
about it quite a bit.
Okay.
I do want to just talk on the alienation of goods, because this is a question that we've asked a number of canonists, and we've asked about 10, we've gotten 15 different opinions. There's a requirement under the Code of Canon Law that if you are alienating funds from the diocese, you have to appeal that if it's over a certain benchmark. I think it's 2 million or something along those lines. If there's any canonists, correct me. If you're going to alienate those funds, you have to appeal to the Holy See prior to doing so. And the question is, if a diocese is taking money from its endowed funds, which you should never have endowed funds as a diocese anyway, that's why you create a foundation. But as you're creating a foundation, if you are taking those funds and gifting them from the diocese to the diocesan foundation, is that actually an alienation of funds under the code of law that triggers the requirement to appeal to the Holy See? The answer I've gotten is yes and no. But most canonists have come with the suggestion that perhaps it's better to beg for forgiveness than ask for permission. That's another canonical question. The response I usually get is either yes, it's an alienation because it's one from a diocesan, it's going from the diocese to a separate corporation, and if a foundation is truly a separate corporation, then it is an alienation of funds. And the other is, I've gotten the response, well, but the funds are still restricted for the purposes by which the diocese was gifted them, and because of that, it's not an alienation. It's just a transfer from one ecclesiastical corporation to another civil, quasi-ecclesiastical corporation. It's very blurry.
And that might come into play with transferring funds from an apostolate within your diocese into the foundation. So within the military archdiocese, we have the promotion for the cause of canonization for Father Capodanno. So the Capodanno Guild is understood within its articles as a public juridic person. Should the Capodanno Guild's funds go to the foundation, then we'll ask 10 different canon lawyers and get 15 different answers. Okay. On my to-do list. Corporate bylaws. We started here and we always get a lot of questions about this. So, John's point was taken well earlier that so often, you know, somebody says, oh, I'll send you my bylaws, and then you slap a different name on top of it and file, you know, vote on them, and it doesn't help you. So the bylaws really are your living document by which the foundation governs itself. So, we didn't go into committee structure very much, though, so I think it merit spending some time there. What do you recommend for a committee structure for a foundation?
So these are the recommendations.
And KU2 for that matter.
I have seen where governance and audit have been merged. That's sort of a new phenomenon because the audit committees, you know, your audit committee up until about 5 years ago was the committee that audited your auditors. They just made sure that the numbers added up. Then, you know, it's a separate, the audit committee should be a very separate committee. Maybe you have one member of the board as the chair, but if you can have a few external accountants on it, it looks really good on paper and it looks good for your audit and for your donors. But no one here from the Papal Foundation. After the Papal Foundation sort of imploded on itself 5 years ago, audit committees went from not just auditing auditors, but being the holder of the conscience of the institution, that not only is your audit committee responsible to make sure that the auditors have the periods in the right place and the commas in the right place and that the numbers all add up, but they're the ones who are making sure that the institution is doing what it is restricted to do, that it's being governed the way it's supposed to be governed, that it's following its bylaws, that it's following its articles, that it's not making grants outside of the world in which it's supposed to be making grants. A good governance committee will do that as well, but you can, I've seen both. I prefer a governance committee as the keeper of the bylaws and the articles, you know, a bunch of lawyers sitting in a room just making sure that everything makes sense, and the audit committee focusing on the financials, but also being the sort of keeper of the conscience of the institution. Nominations committee, again, if you're gonna grow a board of 15 people, you need a good solid nominations committee. I've seen so many institutions where the bishop just puts people on the board, and if the bishop's not active, then the board's not going to grow. Make sure you have a good nominations committee. The way you really grow a foundation like this is you get one incredibly successful person, put them on the board, and then they bring their very successful friends, and they come onto the board rather than the bishop serving as the recruiter of the institution. I've also seen nominations committees, the role of the bishop as the chairman of the board. And I know that a number of you have the bishop as your chair ex officio. I don't like that model, and I'll tell you why. I think the bishop should be the president of the institution, and I think that the bishop should be the corporate member. But I think that you want your chair of the board to be that leader who is reaching out to the community, the person who's well-respected in the community, and so that the bishop has a partner among the wealthy and successful in the community who is the chairman of the board. I know that might be something that would be very difficult for you to implement, but I've also seen foundations that don't work because the bishop doesn't take an interest in the foundation and he is the chairman. And your institution will be held up every time you get a new bishop if you have a bishop who doesn't care. I've seen clients where one bishop is just phenomenal as the chair and the second, his successor in office, has no interest in the diocesan foundation. And the nominations committee also proposes the names of the officers of the corporation in addition to bringing on new members. And I have to say, one of the most important things you can put in your bylaws are term limits, because the worst thing in the world is someone who has been on the board for 25 years because they made a $1 million gift 25 years ago, and you just can't ask them to leave. 3 years, three terms, you get 9 years on the board. If you can't do it in 9 years, you're not going to do it in 25. And if you could be president of the United States for 8, you can serve on a board for 9. Make them emeritus members, but have the board constantly changing. And then finance and investment, clearly, you need to, your finance and investment committee are the people who are watching, Hancock Whitney or Knights of Columbus or whoever else you have investing your funds, an incredibly important committee as well.
Question?
Having emeritus board members, by the way, is a great way to keep people involved, to keep them cultivated, and you can continue asking them for gifts.
Go ahead. Quick clarification on that. So what are your thoughts on, you serve your 3 terms, 3 years, still a 9-term off for a period of time, but you can still be eligible to come back on?
For the recording purpose, if a board member served their 3-year term limit, served at to the extent of their term limit, at what point might they be eligible to come back onto the board, if ever?
I've seen it. It might work in your diocese. I don't think it's a good system. I think 9 years, if you haven't made, you can make your impact in 9 years, and you can make your impact if you continue on as an emeritus member. But it's also saying to the diocese or whatever institution you have that these are the only 15 people that we have who can serve on the board, because we keep bringing them on. We keep bringing them back. And it almost creates fatigue in the institution that, you know, we can't look out. This person is so good that we're going to bring them on for another 9 years. That doesn't make sense to me from a philosophy. And I've also seen boards where it becomes all about that one person because they are so necessary for the foundation that it almost becomes about them.
And you want to keep looking for new members. I had someone call me out of the blue recently when we created the St. John the 23rd Foundation and said, hey, I want to help Catholics in the military. The person was a veteran. He was a Fortune 500 CEO, had never made a gift to the Archdiocese ever. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've got someone who's just kind of fallen into my lap with a lot of talent, good credentials. You know, I know him personally, trust him, and put him on the board, and he's been a great addition. One thing that maybe, Katie, you can talk about from a development perspective is former board members and how being a patron or legacy circles or things like that might be a good way to continue to cultivate without putting someone back on the board.
Yeah, people still get great recognition for their service, for their giving, and it gives them another opportunity to be a leader. It's just in a different way. They're not on the board, but they could be leading a giving society. The one thing I'll mention about advancement committees, as a fundraiser, I would say any person you put on the board, the mentality needs to be they either give, get, or get off. And I'm not just talking about money. I'm talking about time, talent, and treasure. So if you need a lawyer, they can serve. They can give their talent and time by advising on these articles and corporation bylaws, all audit committees, governance. Other people are happy to sponsor events and bring all of their friends into a table. So that's the way I approach inviting people onto the board. They give, get, or get off. And it's time, talent, or treasure.
The easiest way to destroy morale on a board is to put somebody there who thinks that their name gives recognition and credibility to the institution. You can put me on the board, but I'm not going to show up at board meetings. My name is just so wonderful. Go away.
That's an important conversation to have ahead of time. I recently joined a board for a Catholic foundation, and when I got the call from the executive director and asked me to join, he was like, yeah, we're looking for new members, and he didn't go there. He didn't say what he was looking for from me, and I have 3 children in college, and my husband is in the Army, and I'm a diocesan attorney. Like, I'm not swimming in a $1 million gift that I'm looking to give to someone. So I proactively, oh, he's in the room nodding at me right now. So I proactively asked the question, so Jim, what are you looking for from your board members? And Jim rightfully said, we're not looking for a huge gift from you, Elizabeth. We're looking for your service. We're looking for your skill set. We're looking for your expertise. And that took the stress off of me as someone who feels like I have something to give, but I don't have a $500,000 check to write. So thank you, Jim. So next slide or question.
I think that committees do 3 wonderful things. The first is the real work of the board of directors. That's when the rubber hits the road. The second, it's a great way to sort of build and mentor people to serve on the board, and it's a great place to take emeritus members and keep them engaged. And I do think I want to just touch on this, another concern about, you know, I've done my 9 years on the board. Steve did his 9 years. We've both been off for 3 years. But you're bringing Steve back, but not me. Why? And I think that that's something that can really burn a develop a relationship with. So I keep it clean. 9 years, thank you very much. Here's okay. Your clock and your Knight of St. Gregory. Thank you very much.
Perhaps Katie can talk to this a bit. As your capacity building within the foundation, Katie, you have 200 people working for you. The St. John the 23rd Foundation has a part-time executive director and a part-time admin person. And a question we've been having is, it might be time to hire soon. So talk to me about that.
Yeah, it can be very overwhelming to think I have to put up however much money in salary and fringe and benefits to be able to hire a fundraiser. But if you're expecting one person to be the fundraiser and the donor relations person and the communications person and the person that's booking the gift and making sure that the thank you letter goes out and the tax receipt is right, it's a recipe for disaster. So even if you can bring in volunteers, I'm sure there are volunteers within the community that can help with some of those things, but to the extent possible, you really want people, especially your fundraisers, to stay focused on fundraising.
Okay.
One of the things that I've seen as a problem in some boards is you rely too much on the board members to serve as the professionals of the foundation.
Yes.
Your accountant on the board is not the accountant of the foundation. Get a bookkeeper to do that. Your lawyer on the board can help with your articles and bylaws, but they are not the lawyer of the foundation. I've seen so many situations where, you know, our lawyer, well, he does criminal work, but he helps with our articles and our bylaws. In the medical field, that would be like your podiatrist performing heart surgery. If you don't have an expertise in nonprofit governance, then just because you're the lawyer on the board doesn't give you the skill set to be the lawyer of the institution.
Right.
I think that is for a whole range of opportunities. But so often we in church circles think that we can save a bit of money by giving the board. Your board of directors are your board of directors. I had one client that said did an audit of the foundation, and one board member said, well, I'm in the office doing the bookkeeping and I'm also the board member, but I take off my board of directors hat when I do that and I just become Steve in the office. You can't, that's one of the most bizarre, absurd things I've ever heard. You're a board member of the institution. You cannot separate yourself from that. So I understand you're probably small, you have a low budget, but you know, sometimes you got to spend a little to make sure that you're really protecting your institution.
And this also applies between the diocese and the foundation. When your CEO of the diocese is the CEO of the foundation and your bookkeeper of the diocese is the bookkeeper of the foundation, it can get really muddy, such that when Mrs. McGillicuddy, you know, gives her $2,000 check to the diocese, but she meant it to go to the foundation, there's a temptation just to, you know, put it in the diocese fund or endorse it to the foundation, and then all of a sudden you've entangled your two corporations, which can create a humongous problem that is much deeper than Mrs. McGillicuddy's $2,000 shoe grant. So this adequate staffing also applies to between the diocese and the foundation, and to have reasonable expectations that growing takes time. So if you're investing in staff, you're investing in websites, marketing, donor cultivation, you know, you might have a little bit of an exponential curve going on for financial growth. We should probably keep moving along. Selection of board members. We've talked about this a bit, but Katie, who would you identify as a good board member for a Catholic foundation?
Board members are generally already involved in some way. They've shown some leadership ability. And again, they bring time, talent, or treasure to the governance of the board. So they could either lead a committee, serve on a committee, help out with events, whatever it may be. But they are generally people that are involved already. It is rare in my experience that you find someone who has huge capacity and you just invite them onto the board, not really knowing who they are and how they operate and what their priorities are. So it's usually a well-cultivated relationship before you make that ask.
Okay. So we talked. Okay.
I think that, again, that idea that I'm on the board because I give my name. The other worst thing is somebody who's there because it's an honorific for them. Oh, the bishop has invited me to serve on the Diocesan Foundation. I must be so important. Just a very short story that you can. This sort of resonates. I was at the promotion of a one-star general. He was a priest who became head of the Air National Guard. When the four-star put the star on his shoulder, he said, "Father, this star has nothing to do with what you've done. It's a recognition of what you've done, but it's an outward sign of the more that is expected of you." And I think that the more you can convince a board member that their job on a board is fiduciary, which is a legal requirement, and a responsibility to care for the temporal goods of the church rather than just some honor, the better your boards, and ask your board members. So you have to, I think a nomination process where you have a two packet where the nominators put, but the nominee is also filling out something, talking about why they would be on the board, and maybe have an examination of conscience. Are there things that, from your past, that could come back to bite the board or to embarrass the institution, gives them an opportunity for reflection.
Right. It's like the Will Ferrell line from Saturday Night Live. I drive a Dodge Stratus. I'm important. Like, that's not who you want on your board. So, okay, selecting board members. And then we had a conversation in our foundations forum on Saturday about whether a gift is through the foundation or to the foundation. And Corey and I might have disagreed a little bit in delivery, but not actual substance. So I will reiterate that a gift to the foundation is a gift to the foundation. A gift to the diocese is a gift to the diocese.
10:51 a.m.
Thank you. John and Katie, what might you add to that?
I think that we, maybe it's because you've got three lawyers in the front of the room, but if the title of the next presentation should have been how to prepare for bankruptcy that might never come. And I think that that's how your foundation has to operate. If you're doing good asset protection, then you're always wondering about what would this look like in front of a bankruptcy judge? And Corey, who's in the midst of that, made the point very clear. What did they look for? They didn't look at their articles. They didn't look at their bylaws. They didn't look at their structure. They didn't look at their website. They looked at their checks. Who's cashing the check? Is the check made out to the foundation or is the check made out to the diocese? And is there a back and forth of those assets and those funds? So I actually got in a fight with somebody the other day who was a good controller of a diocese who said, you know, we have parish funds, but it's not a grant because those parishes are entitled to that. Every penny that goes out from your foundation that is in the form, assets held for others, you know, agency funds, those are something different. But any fund that is taking money from its investment portfolio and gifting it to its beneficiary is a grant from your foundation and must be done by a resolution of the board of directors to that beneficiary.
Good question.
Don't think those assets are protected. You're basically functioning as a bank when you're holding agency funds or funds held for others until it's a gift to the foundation. And I think you have to make that clear. If Our Lady of Perpetual Motion is putting $100,000 into the foundation for the next 10 years as it's building its, holy water font at the back of the church, you have to explain to them, you know, just because you're investing it in the foundation. My question would be, have you spoken to your diocesan attorney as to whether or not your foundation's attorney, as to whether or not the acceptance of those funds held for others creates liability on the part of the foundation for the action of those? And that's a question, the liability would be minimal, but I think that that is something that you need to discuss with your foundation's attorney.
And going back a slide, one thing that we didn't talk to about assets and commingling, when a foundation is smaller, just growing, it's not atypical for the diocese and the foundation to share staff. But then for the diocese to do functions for the foundation. So then how do you ensure that those functions are truly separate and distinct? And as much as sometimes memoranda of agreement can be muddy, a solid memorandum of agreement voted by the board for your foundation that directs what is done by the diocese and held to it is really important. And the way we did the one between the Archdiocese for the Military Services and the St. John the 23rd Foundation, the Archdiocese does some bookkeeping for the St. John the 23rd Foundation, and we just laid out a kind of the whereas the parties are distinct, whereas the parties desire for bookkeeping services, you know, be it resolved that the Archdiocese for the Military Services will perform these functions for the St. John the 23rd Foundation. There are five functions only, and it will not be expanded because then you get into that problem of entanglement and potentially commingling.
And at this cost, if you have a cost, you should have a cost because it is a service agreement.
Correct.
It's a good way to move money around. But make sure two things. You are paying that cost because that shows that the contract exists. If you're not paying those costs, make sure you get a letter from the foundation to the diocese acknowledging those services as a gift.
Great. Okay. Oops. Yes, sir. Okay, we'll go ma'am, and then we'll go sir.
Should we just, I know we've got some more slides, but we've got 7 minutes, so I'm sure there's questions.
Okay, great. So get your CRM right. And We'll open it up to questions.
And I do want to point out, the Basilica is one of our clients. Katie advises the Basilica on its fundraising and its capital campaign. I'm building the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception Preservation Trust, which is a foundation that we're going to build over time for the preservation of the shrine. But we at JKT Group paid for the flag that flew outside of the shrine on Labor Day. So.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
In the middle of all these sort of like questions, what goes here, what goes there. And we have several endowments set up in the Archdiocese. Can you, is it best to move them to the foundation?
Yes.
Because there's a big question around piercing the veil and being afraid about doing all that. Yeah.
I would ask the question, why have you created a foundation if you're not putting those assets into it? The very reason for that is the asset protection. I think that any diocese in the United States in this legal world, it's almost suicidal to have endowed funds on the books of the diocese. That's the first thing that plaintiffs and counsel is going to look at. I think, put it as a gift from the diocese into the foundation, because that's why.
It's as easy as that, a gift from the Archdiocese to the foundation.
So what you want to do is have, if your diocese is governed, if your diocese is a corporation sole,
if your diocese is a corporation sole, you have the corporate member, which is the bishop, gift those assets by a resolution at a meeting of the corporate member. He sits in the room by himself and passes a resolution to gift those assets. If your diocese is a nonprofit corporation, then you have a meeting of the board of directors of the corporation to gift those assets to the foundation. So you're creating a corporation. You're creating that corporate resolution, which is an action of the board to gift those assets. But then on top of that, make sure that the foundation is acknowledging that money as a gift so that you're showing that this is an alienation of fund between two parties.
And a question that usually follows is, does that eliminate the risk of this endowment that for 93 years was held by the diocese and now is held by the foundation? No, but not entirely, right? But it does help any endowment that's established in your foundation going forward, because it's clear that it was never a diocesan diocesan endowment or diocesan asset. Thank you for that. Okay. And then gray sir in the gray shirt.
Did you have another question?
Yeah, thank you. So I guess it was going back to the concept of alienation of gifts, because that's a new term for me. So, could you were kind of talking about it a little bit there, where funds going back and forth between the diocese and the foundation. Could you talk a little bit about that again, just exactly what that is?
Sure.
Perfect example is somebody wants to give $1 million to general support of the diocese. And the diocese accepts that gift from that individual, and then the diocese looks at this and says, oh, we just got this $1 million gift. We should put it over to the foundation. And instead of, well, first, the gift should have been made directly to the foundation. That's the cleanest way to do it. But then you have a good-intentioned CFO decides, well, we're just going to give it to the foundation. We're not going to tell them. We're just going to transfer it to Catholic Investment Services or CBIS or Knights of Columbus through a wire, and just, you know, we're just going to put that money into the foundation rather than doing it the right way, which is, you know, cut a check from the diocese to the foundation, acknowledging that this is a gift from the diocese to the general endowed fund of the foundation. But the cleanest way to do this is make sure that there's a distinction in the mind of your donors, that they can make a gift to the foundation for the foundation. And that also comes into play with parish funds. I know that there's a lot of you who have parish funds within your foundation endowments. Set up a system by which your parishioners can make a gift directly to the parish fund, because if they go to the pastor, Father is never going to take a $10,000 gift and say, I think we're going to put this in the foundation endowment. Father's going to take that $10,000 gift, and he's going to use it for his budget or for the new air conditioning or for the roof repair. There is always something going on at the parish that Father will need that money for. So if you can create an understanding among the faithful of the diocese that they can give to their parishes 401k or IRA directly by making a gift to the foundation, it helps build those assets.
So we'll take one more question if it can be brief. Yeah.
Yesterday at the forum was the difference between a Catholic
community foundation and a foundation,
yeah.
a Catholic foundation.
So the community foundation, so like for New Orleans, for example, uses that university model. It's brought everything into the community foundation, schools, newspaper, hospitals. And so the Archdiocese of New Orleans doesn't, from what I understand from Corey Howitt, so ask him, but doesn't do the fundraising. So it looks like the university model that Katie was talking about. And then this, something like the St. John the 23rd Foundation, which is what the Military Archdiocese has, we still have a development office. So we still have an office of advancement that's staffed, that does operational gifts that are not held in endowments, and the foundation holds the endowments. So the fundraising that the foundation does is for endowed gifts only, and then within the Archdiocese, it's cash. Yeah. John and Katie, do you want to share a little bit about JKT, and then we'll let you all go?
Sure. In the midst of COVID, we had a bright idea. Katie and our third partner, Tom, we all went to Catholic U together. Katie's got a law degree and an MBA from Tulane. I've got a law degree. Tom's got a master's in public policy from NYU. And we realized that there was a market from just friends coming to us. Oh, you work in this nonprofit world. Maybe you can help us out with this small nonprofit. We'd have to say, well, no, we can't, because we have employers who won't let us do that. But after taking apart and restructuring a foundation, we all realized that there was a market for this. And so we created JKT Group as a means by which Catholic and non-Catholic, we have non-Catholic clients as well, could just have experts come in and take a look at your organization. So Katie does fundraising consulting. She can help you build an annual fund. She can help you build an endowed giving program. She can work with you to look at the numbers, look at your donors, restructure your database. But my work at the firm is all the way from an audit, you know, give me 10 hours, I'll come in and I'll talk to your board. I'll look at your bylaws, I'll look at your articles, I'll tell you what I think you need to be successful, and I'll present at the board of directors meeting, and I'll give you a 5-page memo that outlines that, all the way to we are building a diocesan foundation, give JKT Group the keys and we will build it for you from the ground up and give those keys back to you in 3 years, to we have a foundation but we don't know what we're doing with it. I come in for 3 years, 2 to 3 years, and serve as the acting executive director to get that project. And I do believe that the person who builds a foundation and the person who manages a foundation are two very different people. It's very different skill sets. And you almost need someone who has that legal background to build a foundation from the ground up, because, you know, articles of incorporation, bylaws, governance, that's not fundraising stuff. And that would drive a fundraiser crazy. And if you asked me to go out and fundraise, I would go crazy doing it, because it's, I bill, I don't beg.
Thanks, everyone. Don't forget to fill out your MUVA evaluation, if you have it. So check it out here. Session 18. Breaks till 11:45 is lunch.
And I'll load the slides into the Whova app, but if you'd prefer that I email them, just grab my card at the front of the room and I'll just send you the PowerPoint.